The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Ben Henry, and I'm here with Sarah Gibson, who is a reporter here at New Hampshire Public Radio. Hey, Sarah.
Hey.
So you've been spending a lot of time with a woman named Natasha Davis. Tell me about Davis.
Sure. So I met Natasha Davis at a recovery coach training in Nashua. She's training to be a recovery coach and kind of got involved with that because of her own experience going through recovery.
What is a recovery coach?
A recovery coach is basically someone, they're not a licensed therapist, but they do go through a program and a training and a kind of licensure in order to offer support on a regular basis to someone who's going through recovery, be it making sure they're going to their doctor's appointments, just kind of processing what it's like to try to stay sober. They're often at kind of recovery centers throughout the state.
Take me back to before Natasha was a recovery coach. Tell me about how she got here. Where does that story start?
Yeah, well, she says it starts more than 15 years ago when she was caught up in the juvenile justice system frequently, just getting a lot of fights, getting suspended from school, drinking alcohol.
Where is she from?
She's from Nashua.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, that's an interesting thing about people who are experiencing recovery. Often their comrades in recovery are people they went to high school with, people they used with, people they sold drugs to, bought drugs from. It's a close-knit community, and in some ways that can mean it's supportive. It can also mean you can't get away sometimes from your demons.
Mm-hmm.
She did try rehab many times, cycled in and out of jail. She was working, working jobs, raising three kids, and finally she had a series of arrests about a year ago. She was caught up in a drug sting that, with the combination of various other things she already had hanging over her head, meant that she was going to face years in state prison. This kind of was the culmination where the justice system had not worked for her. That makes her kind of the perfect candidate for drug court.
Hello and welcome to Word of Mouth from NHPR. This is part of our series on incarceration in New Hampshire. Today, we're going behind the closed doors of a program designed to divert people with substance use disorders from incarceration and instead provide them with treatment for addiction and mental health. It's called drug court, and it's a relatively new idea here in New Hampshire. We're still figuring out how it works, why it works, and for whom it doesn't work. Sarah Gibson covers southern New Hampshire for NHPR, and she's been reporting on opioids and criminal justice and following the story of Natasha Davis and her experience in drug court. Can you give me, a quick overview? What is drug court?
Sure. So drug court, nationally, it's been around for officially 30 years, so it's celebrating a little bit of a birthday nationally this year. But in New Hampshire, it's expanded since 2016. And the idea with them, they're called treatment courts. And the notion behind them is you take the high-risk, high-need people who are reoffending, who have a state prison sentence kind of hanging over their head, and you give them intense, intense community supervision and intense amounts of treatment for what could be about 2 years. It's basically like an intense form of probation. So if you do not succeed at drug court, if you kind of fail out of it, you head to state prison. And so it's not necessarily like a protective mechanism against people from state prison. It's basically the notion is these people can probably access drugs when they're in prison. They have severe underlying addiction. And the only way we're going to reverse this trend is to give them intensive treatment and intensive supervision, because when they have left state prison in 3 years, they're likely going to recidivate and kind of start all over again.
You said she had been to rehab numerous times. Did you talk with her about that, what rehab was like for her?
Yeah, she said it was the kind of thing where people would laugh at her when she said, I'm going to go this time and it's going to be different. People said, you're a broken record. We've heard it before. You know, there are a lot of ways in which people talk about treatment needing all these different components and not all those components were there.
Yeah, when we talk about rehab, we're talking about these are like 4-week programs generally, right?
Yeah, I mean, the time is limited often because of how much health insurance will pay for. So there's, you know, a lot of debate about whether or not 28 days is enough, but that's typically the length.
It sounds like for people like Davis and I think for a lot of people, you know, addiction can take years to deal with. 28 days is kind of just vastly inadequate.
Yeah. And that's kind of a consensus among people who work in the drug court world is if you've been dealing with addiction for 15 years, for 20 years, for 30 years, it's not going to go away in 28 days. It's not going to go away in 2 years necessarily. I mean, you're going to be struggling with it. You're going to need to kind of create a mechanism for dealing with it for the rest of your life. So 28 days, I mean, it can be really effective. It's also a drop in the bucket compared to the amount of time people have been very addicted to drugs.
Yeah, it's not to say that rehab centers are doing anything wrong or that they don't work for a lot of people. It's that there's a very important demographic of people for whom rehab centers are really inadequate.
Yeah.
Sarah, when you covered this for the newsroom, Davis let you come along with her to drug court. You talked to the judge who oversees the Nashua drug court. So I want to play that part of your story for the listeners.
So the idea with drug court is to break the cycle.
That's Judge Jacqueline Colburn. She helped start the Nashua drug court around 5 years ago, before the idea had taken off statewide. She was sick of seeing people like Davis cycle through jail and prison where they didn't get enough help.
The reality is when they're released back to the same community, the same situation. Their skill set is no greater than it was when they went in, and they will continue to do that which they know how to do.
In drug court, participants get treatment and community supervision. The program lasts about 2 years, and it's divided into phases.
So if you're in a phase one participant, your life is pretty much 24/7 drug court.
Participants spend hours each day in mandatory group and individual therapy. They have random curfew checks and urine tests multiple times a week, and they have to check in with the drug court team and the rest of participants regularly.
I'm state property, basically.
At the beginning, Davis learned the two rules of drug court: show up and be honest no matter what.
Drug court doesn't like to be lied to, especially Judge Colburn. Do not lie to Judge Colburn or Nellie. Nellie especially.
Nellie is the probation officer. Another person on the drug court team you shouldn't lie to, Lieutenant Brian Kenny. He's in charge of narcotics at the Nashua Police. Kenny and his officers keep tabs on all the drug court participants. He says many struggle at first with telling the truth to cops.
To be honest, I don't even expect it in the beginning. I expect it not to occur if we're getting the right people into drug court. It's supposed to be the most high-risk offenders that we have. You know, and that's high risk of reoffending and high risk, frankly, of overdosing.
That happened for Davis, but she got help and stayed in drug court. Her urine tests have been clean for 5 months, until a few weeks ago when she tested positive for a prohibited substance. That's what brings her into court today. Davis heads into the courtroom with about 10 other women. There's a table set up in the middle where a team of social workers, cops, a public defender, and recovery coaches sit with Judge Colburn. Participants join the table one by one to talk about how they're doing. This accountability to community, it's a big part of why people say drug court works. With one woman, the team believes she's relapsed, but she's denying it, which gets eye rolls from other participants. Another woman, Davis's former drug dealer, is about to graduate. Then it's Davis's turn.
All right, Natasha, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Better?
Better. What's that mean?
Davis says she's been depressed, but she's getting help at the recovery center. Then they get down to business. Davis has to explain that positive urine test, which contained a banned ingredient found in cold medicine.
So bump in the road this week around the cold medicine. So when I read the report, I was sort of surprised because I thought, wow, Natasha is so smart and she knows what's on the do not take list.
Davis has this list in her kitchen. It includes energy drinks and poppy seed bagels, which can interfere with testing, and cold medicine, which some people use to boost their high. Davis says she had come down with the flu and needed the medicine to get through a long day of training for a potential job, which, by the way, she's supposed to have to stay compliant with drug court. But Colburn says rules are rules.
It's New Hampshire, and it's February, and guess what? You might get sick again next month. And so at some point, you're going to have to make a decision about whether you do one thing to the exclusion of another thing, right? Choices.
Colburn gives Davis a warning, no punishment. Davis tells me later, this kind of thing makes her feel like a teenager, but she gets it. And there's positive affirmation here, too, for volunteering at a recovery center and for not relapsing during a depression.
So despite having to come in on your unscheduled week, it's not all bad, right? So advice to your peers.
Don't take cold medicine.
The reality is that not everyone at that table is totally on the same page. I mean, everyone has slightly different opinions about what drug court should be. So there are some people there who say we should be carting people off to jail more. There are some people who are participants in the program who say we should not be so lenient with people. And there are others who say it's too much still, like, you know, still following the logic of the criminal justice system to some extent, you know, if you're sending someone to jail.
What kind of perspectives did you hear from people who are skeptical of this idea, this approach?
Yeah, the biggest fear is that someone who is in drug court should have gone directly to prison.
These are folks that you did a lot of hard work on to place under arrest and to get into the court system to solve whatever problem was occurring in the city. And now they're just back in the community? How is this possible?
How do we know that drug court works? What do we know about that?
Yeah, so the data is tricky, and we can talk about why it's tricky, but...
You took a deep breath.
Yeah, I did.
As somebody who's tried to hunt down data about opioid treatment, it can be tough.
Yeah, so there have been various studies, localized often, say in New York City, looking at people who complete drug court versus those who don't, and the rate of recidivism for people who complete drug court is substantially lower than people who are not offered a drug court opportunity or who go to prison and, you know, recidivate after they get out. But the thing that you got to really track is 3 years out, because recidivism rates are often, you look at, you know, in the long run, after 3 years out of prison, how many people either violated their probation or were imprisoned again. And so you have to follow a drug court participant after their graduation, after aftercare, for 3 years to really have a sense of what their recidivism rate is. In New Hampshire, the data is tricky because people move around, and it could be that Rockingham County is not seeing you up in their system having been arrested again, but that you were arrested in Carroll County. It would behoove the state to really have a statewide data collection process and get some, you know, data analysis to see how well people do 3 years after graduation.
I want to talk about interactions with the police and the role of police in this whole process.
Yeah. So one of the things, and this kind of depends a little bit on the police officer who's in charge and who's the liaison to the drug court team. You can be really proactive about having your cops assigned to drug court participants. And so, for instance, in Nashua, oftentimes it's the cops who are helping do these curfew checks that, like, normally a probation officer would do. So there's a cop who shows up at your door, even if you're sleeping, at 11 p.m., which is what happens to Davis. She has to get out of bed and say, like, hey, I'm here. Yes, this is how my day was. That's part of the curfew check. It's cops who are doing that. Cops know who's in drug court. And so that means that if they hear someone over the radio, if they, you know, stop a car and someone's using, or they do a drug bust, if there's someone who's in drug court who is there, that's going to be a major problem for them. And that will be reported back to the drug court team. Hmm. And so
this sounds like a very intense relationship with police.
It's an intense relationship, and there's a lot of surveillance. I mean, you're not free. You're not free if you're in drug court at all. There is a lot of surveillance, and there's a lot of support, and there's there are a lot of rules. And people say that's why it works. But it also means that you can, you know, have really changed your life around and still have a huge prison sentence over your head and interact with police who sometimes are not convinced that you've gotten better and that you've changed your ways and that you are in recovery. But the cop's job is kind of to see whether or not drug court participants are relapsing, are doing the things they did a year ago. And it definitely creates tension. And it's definitely going to create tension if not all cops are on board with drug court as a model and as an idea. And so if you're a cop who just doesn't like drug court, and there are those cops for sure in New Hampshire, you're not going to be extra gracious to a drug court participant.
We'll have to take up a lot of your time and let you go because you are a news reporter and you have to go do news.
News, yeah. Well,
Sarah, thank you for taking the time.
You're welcome.
That was Sarah Gibson. You can hear her on the radio all the time telling you the news. She covers Southern New Hampshire. I want to say, like always, Word of Mouth is a show about answering the questions that you, listening to this right now, have about New Hampshire. Any question. For example, why is the Confederate flag so popular this far above the Mason-Dixon line? Or is the Mall of New Hampshire dying? Kind of feel like it's dying. Email us, wordofmouth@nhpr.org.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth. I'm Erica Janik. We're taking a look at a New Hampshire first, the first novel published by an African American, a woman from New Hampshire. In 1859, a Mrs. H. E. Wilson published a novel at her own expense. The book told the story of a biracial girl named Fredo, abandoned by her mother to be raised by a prominent family, where she suffered verbal and physical abuse at the hand of her employers, in a New Hampshire town famous for its abolitionist activities. The novel didn't sell well, likely less than 100 copies, and the book, as well as its author, fell into obscurity.
So in 2002, there was an article in our paper. In February 2002, a reporter wrote Milford's Forgotten Daughter, and that was the first reference that I had ever seen in our town about Harriet Wilson, the first black woman to publish a novel in the world. And she was born here and lived here in Milford.
That's Jerry Ann Bogus, executive director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. She met me on a windy afternoon in Milford.
I was blown away. And so I went out and got the book right away and I read it and it was just absolutely fascinating. Just a story that opened up a new way to view our town, a new way to view our state, that black people actually were born and raised here in the 1700s and on. So not just passing through on their way to Canada, but were vital part of our New Hampshire culture.
Harriet Wilson had first come to light in the early 1980s when Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. had rediscovered the novel and verified the identity of its author, a black woman.
He was in an antique bookstore, and sometimes he says the book fell on the ground right in front of him. But he's a good storyteller. But anyway, that was part of his doctoral dissertation to prove that. He said after he read it that it was written by a person of color. People had taught that it was written by a white male. It was actually cataloged in books as books written by white male about slavery.
But that rediscovery was made in the 1980s. And by the 2000s, few outside the scholarly community knew Harriet Wilson's name. Even people in Milford, like Jerry Ann. She didn't want Wilson's name to disappear again, so she formed the Harriet Wilson Project to celebrate and share her story. Harriet was born Harriet Adams in Milford in 1825. Her father was a free black man. Her mother's identity isn't certain, but some believe she was a white woman from Portsmouth who moved to Milford. Milford was, at the time, a stronghold of abolitionism.
In the 1800s, early 1800s, there was a abolitionist convention, an anti-slavery convention, which they said that all the major speakers on the trail were there. Garrison was there, Frederick Douglass was there, you know, a whole host. It was a two-day convention. The Hutchinson family, too, from Milford, were very popular abolitionist singers that toured along with Douglas, and you know, they were on that whole lecture circuit, and they were from Milford here.
Oh, the car Emancipation rides majestic through our nation, bearing on its train the story, liberty, a nation's glory.
So Milford definitely, it's been quoted in the town histories as a hotbed for abolitionists.
Harriet's father died when she was 7. Her mother remarried, but abandoned Harriet to work for the Hayward family as an indentured servant. She was 7 years old. We don't know much about her life beyond what she wrote in her book. She attended school for 3 summers and likely worked for a few other families.
From her book, when she leaves Milford, she moves to a W town, is what she puts in her book. And Wilson meets 2 people that were very influential in her life. One person, she writes in her book that she got the formula for hair products, and you know, she sells this product door to door. She'd be quite entrepreneurial.
Harriet's hair business is a more recent discovery about the novelist. She's said to have gotten the recipe for restoring gray hair to its natural color from a friend. Ads for Mrs. Wilson's hair regenerator appeared as early as 1857. The other influential person she met when she left New Hampshire was a woman who instilled a love of books and reading. In 1851, Harriet married Thomas Wilson, but he was a con man who abandoned her and their newborn son George a year later. Harriet, often ill and left destitute by her husband, had to leave George at a poor farm while she earned money selling hair products and maybe working as a dressmaker. It's at this time that she starts writing.
And at that time, the slave narratives were making former enslaved people wealthy. They, you know, the abolitionist movement really flourished with those books.
Harriet thought she could make a living off of her story and asked for people to rally around her so she could support her child.
So Wilson's book, Our Negro Sketches in the Life of a Free Black, talks about Fredo, the hero, heroine in the story. She gets abandoned to the B family in the book. Her mother drops her off there, so the book tells about her life growing up with this family and how she went from being called her name to becoming our nig. And so it talks about the ill treatment by Mrs. B, the mother in the family, and one of the daughters. It's one passage in there where Mrs. B puts her out in the sun to make sure that she is never mistaken for one of her children. So that tells us 2 things. She was biracial, she was probably light skin, but you know, it was important that she looked dark so nobody would mistake her. So that's the story. It's her coming of age of this young girl in a young biracial girl in a predominantly white town and home.
But the novel, published by an abolitionist printer in Boston, was a hard sell.
Wilson's writing, right, her book was contrary to the notion of what would have sold as a slave narrative, because they wanted the overcoming stories, right? And Wilson's book, even though it was so small, it tore apart all of the treasured institutions of the day. Let's take motherhood, right? You know, Mrs. B, the protagonist in the novel, was an evil woman, you know, to her children. So motherhood took a blow. The church, she called the church, you know, hypocrites. The abolitionist movement, they were hypocritical, because she says, here, you're going to be fighting for this, but you won't have one of us to dinner in your home.
Documentary evidence has shown that many of the details of the book are literally true, aside from the names. A few months after the book's publication, Harriet's son George, the reason for her book, died.
Her son dies, right? The book came out 59 months, just a few months after publishing her book, her son dies. And that's what was the goal she had put in. I can imagine that she quite, you know, took a really blow for that. And that was just not something that she would want to you know, that could have put a dampening on how much she put in the writing and stuff. But we do know she becomes a lecturer on the lecture circuits, and she talks about child abuse, and she talks about, she becomes actually a famous spiritualist.
Sadly, it was her son's death that provided the proof of Harriet's race. Gates found his death certificate, which lists his mother as a black woman. As far as we know, Harriet didn't keep writing after George died. She did return to her hair care business. She also joined the lecture circuit and became deeply involved with the spiritualist movement. She died in 1900. In 2006, the Harriet Wilson Project unveiled a statue of the writer. Sculptor Fern Cunningham, who'd previously done the Harriet Tubman Memorial in Boston, was commissioned for the work. But unlike Tubman, we don't know what Wilson looked like.
But we didn't ask for, we asked for a single monument of a woman. And Fern sent in a proposal that had George. And she said, her proposal said, well, if it wasn't for her son, Wilson wouldn't have written the book. So how could we have just a statue of just Harriet without her son? Because he was the impetus for her writing the book. So she won.
The statue on a patch of lawn in Bicentennial Park depicts Harriet holding her book. Her son George is just behind her in the folds of her dress. Jerry Ann tells me the figure is designed for engagement. This is a statue to jump up on. To prove it, she hops up the steps to read me the passage from the open pages of the book in Harriet's hands.
So on here you can go up, and this is the moment she, so Fern asked us what she should write in here, because she said, again, if you're interacting with the public, then you wouldn't have a blank sheet. She wanted something there. So stop, shouted Fredo. Strike me and I'll never work a mite more for you. And throwing down what she had gathered, stood like one who feels the stirring of free and independent thoughts. By this unexpected demonstration,
Jerry Ann has done much to change the story for Harriet Wilson, but Harriet has also changed Jerry Ann and her relationship with New Hampshire.
It really gave me a sense of belonging. Now, Wilson's story is not my story. I'm not African American. I was born in Jamaica and came here to college. But discovering that blacks were always a vital, integral part of New Hampshire's history changed the way I look at the state. It created roots in a place that it formerly had no roots for me. And once you belong, once you feel that you belong to a place, you are invested in it. You're invested in many, many ways. You're invested in it in, I mean, I've always thought it's beautiful town, beautiful state, the mountains. There's a lot of it that reminds me of home, the mountains, the oceans, the rivers, you know, so it's comfortable there. And that created that sense of connection in nature, but culturally was totally fractured from a culture here. But discovering Wilson's story here and all of the black history in Portsmouth and finding out all the other places, you know, Key and Jaffrey, everywhere else in the state, creates that, yeah, I belong here just as much as you do.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Erica Janik. Our next story takes us inside the hallways of power. Jackie Helbert tells us what lobbyists do and how lobbying works in the latest story from Civics 101, New Hampshire.
The House will come to order.
When I visit the New Hampshire State House, I can immediately tell the difference between legislators and lobbyists. The citizen legislators mostly dress in sensible suits.
All those in favor say aye.
A few wear L.L. Bean duck boots. The lobbyists, on the other hand, dress to impress. Tailored suits, silk ties, and Italian leather dress shoes.
They are all required to register and then wear these orange names tags in the State House. These very prominent sort of day glow orange.
It's either a warning sign or it means, like, don't shoot me. I haven't been able to figure out which.
Salutations, and welcome to Civics 101 New Hampshire. Today, we're talking about lobbyists. Some people see them as everything that is wrong with politics.
There's definitely this kind of like vision of like the old white guy in an Armani suit with a big check from Philip Morris in his pocket.
While others see them as vital advocates for causes. Jackie Helbert is going to see if lobbyists are actually low-down scoundrels slipping cash into the pockets of lawmakers to buy their votes, or if it's more complicated.
They say they're for the experienced smoker.
I guess I learned fast.
Philip Morris, we'd be proud to have you try them.
Lobbyists have been lurking the halls under the Golden Dome for as long as anyone can remember.
Because one of the things that lobbyists have to do is live up to their name, and that is be hanging out in the lobby in case they need you. So we do walk the halls. We talk to legislators. You know, in a lot of states, legislators have offices that you can go to.
We can't squeeze all 424 lawmakers and over 500 registered lobbyists into the New Hampshire State House at the same time.
Here, legislators do it from their kitchen table. So it's important to be in the State House so you can catch legislators and talk to them if you need to, because you're not going to be able to get office time with them like other states might do. I'm Jim Demers, and I am a lobbyist here in New Hampshire. Have been doing it now for about 25 to 30 years.
Jim is wearing a snazzy pinstripe suit. A magazine cover with his face and the headline, Paid to Persuade, hangs over his desk. New Hampshire Magazine named him one of the 10 most powerful people in the state. Jim's love of politics started early, really early.
He begins the most important campaign of his life.
As a little boy, I went to my mother one time and said, I want to work on a presidential campaign. It was Edmund Muskie's campaign.
Ed Muskie, candidate.
Democratic strategist Jim Demers has been working on presidential campaigns in New Hampshire for decades.
Jim not only realized his dream, but he also served 3 terms in the New Hampshire House of Representatives. So he knows how things really work behind the scenes. If you don't know what a lobbyist does, don't worry.
These are folks who their job, their gig, is to advocate for certain points of view on behalf of clients or the people who employ them.
That's one of our guides to navigating New Hampshire's pay-to-play.
Jacqueline Benson, and I am the content editor of Citizens Count. We cover New Hampshire candidates, elected officials, and policy, and we do it in a completely nonpartisan way. I am also a writer of saucy historical fiction that likes to bleed into all sorts of different genres like sci-fi and romance.
Lobbyists are people who represent special interests, business, labor, the elderly, consumers. They try to convince lawmakers to vote for or against particular bills.
It can be a lucrative career. Jim's firm represents 35 clients, and it's a mixed bag.
Stand with the Alzheimer's Association today.
Walmart, always low prices. Always.
For that good taste that comes from Winston's Filter Blend tobaccos.
You might be asking yourself, why is lobbying legal? Isn't it just bribing lawmakers?
Free speech.
The First Amendment gives the people the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, which gives New Hampshireites, or is it New Hampshireoids, the right to advocate to the state government. People can meet with lawmakers, they can testify at hearings, and that same freedom of speech extends to businesses and groups.
And, you know, part of it is salesmanship, that you have to have the interpersonal skills to get before legislators. You've got to be able to explain and sell the position of your client.
Jackie says some lobbyists can be seen as plucky superheroes.
Plucky superheroes. It really just, I think, depends on, do you agree with what this particular lobbyist is trying to sell or not?
Lobbyists aren't just hired by corporations. Nonprofits, unions, and advocacy groups hire lobbyists.
We joke often that a lobbyist is an educator of elected officials. legislators need to go somewhere to get the information they need, because they're going to act on maybe 1,200 pieces of legislation this year. And it's impossible, you know, for everyone to be an expert on every topic. So lobbyists play a very critical role in helping them sort through the information they get.
That's why he says his personal credibility is the most important part of the job.
That means that you've got to be honest and upfront. And I've seen lobbyists who have kind of fudged the facts at times, and they don't last long in the business. Legislators, they want to know that they're dealing with a square shooter and they can trust you, that you're giving them accurate information.
I think one of the defining characteristics of New Hampshire's legislature is, of course, that it's a citizen legislature. So there's a lot of familiarity between the elected officials in Concord and the people that they represent, but also the people that they deal with on a day-to-day basis, and that can include lobbyists.
That's New Hampshire Public Radio reporter Casey McDermott.
NHPR's Casey McDermott has been reporting on the influence of lobbying money.
In doing reporting on lobbying and asking lawmakers about their relationships with those in the lobbying community, one of the things that I actually heard a lot was that, you know, look, these guys are not the big bad wolf. These guys are nice people. They're just trying to do a job. And I actually count many of them as my friends. That's something that lawmakers told me.
Is it all an old boys network? The same lobbyists rubbing the same shoulders of all the same lawmakers? I asked if Jim considers a lot of the legislators his friends.
Well, because I'm not just a lobbyist, but I'm active in politics as well, a lot of the people who are legislators are friends of mine. So there is that level of relationship that exists. But I think, you know, just like any business, you make professional relationships here. It's not like, you know, there's 400 people at the State House and I spend my birthday party with all 400 of them because they're my best friends.
Happy birthday to you.
You want to have civil relationships between people in a political setting, but I think that on the flip side of that, it does raise some questions about the level of kind of closeness and, you know, really the kind of barriers or independence between the people who are making policy and the people whose job it is to influence policy.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Committee on Public and Municipal Affairs, to which was referred Senate Bill 398-FN.
Lobbyists don't just whisper information into the ear of lawmakers. They can also initiate legislation for their client. They do that by convincing a lawmaker to sponsor a bill, rounding up co-sponsors, writing up talking points, testifying, and sometimes they even write the actual bill itself for lawmakers to copy and paste.
This bill could easily be called New Hampshire's version of the McCain-Feingold.
Good lobbyists don't take their eye off the bill.
You have to babysit legislation through the whole process because you never know when all of a sudden the bill could be amended and turned into something that you never expected would happen. So it is a process that requires attention, and it's not over until it's over, until the bill is either defeated or signed into law. Anything can happen in between.
The committee amendment adds some clarifying language to the legislation.
All of that hands-on involvement can make people uncomfortable with their level of influence. Casey again.
I mean, one of the things about lobbying as a profession is that these are people whose job it is to understand how government works. They can spend the day, because they're paid to do so, sitting in committee hearings, waiting outside in the hallway to talk to someone, setting up meetings with individual legislators, testifying on bills, you know, doing all of the things that go into influencing policy. Whereas the average citizen may have to take time off of work to sit in a hearing, they may have to make arrangements to be able to be there and spend the same amount of time getting the same amount of attention from their lawmakers. So I think there's a sense that maybe sometimes it creates an uneven playing field.
This has given lobbyists an image problem.
part of that is earned. But it goes back to the days, particularly in Washington, when the profession wasn't very regulated, and you heard horror stories about elected officials going on trips to Bermuda and, you know, private airplanes taking them places. And so there were, you know, some lobbyists that created problems because they were, you know, excessive in the gifts that they gave out, and some elected officials were excessive in taking some of those gifts. You hear less of that today because there are tight ethics laws that have been imposed.
With so much power comes great regulation. Well, some regulation.
My lobbying bill is in the process of a committee of conference. I just want the lobbyists to register and report so we'll be aware of who they are and what they are. Okay. It's a pretty important bill. We haven't changed it since 1909 except for those orange tags.
It's a fight to get regulations passed in New Hampshire. Most proposals die in the House. The last one successfully passed was 10 years ago.
But I think we've gone too far with this. I think we need to sit down and think about it for a while. I don't think we need to do this.
Since then, every single regulation bill has died in committee. And then there is the matter of the revolving door.
When I ran in 1986, the outcome of that race didn't quite turn out the way that I had hoped. And I knew at that point that I needed to do something that put food on the table, because I couldn't afford to be a candidate every 2 years and not win.
Remember how Jim was a lawmaker and then he became a legislator? That's a common path for lobbyists and politicians. A lobbyist runs for elected office, or a politician becomes a lobbyist at the end of the term. Unlike other states, New Hampshire doesn't have a mandatory cooling off period.
There are no restrictions on legislators entering the private sector after leaving government. So, you know, that includes a legislator could walk out of the state house and the next term return, but actually wearing one of those orange badges as a lobbyist.
The individuals entrusted with regulating industries once worked for those industries, or will work for them in the future.
I don't recall ever a story about a New Hampshire lobbyist or a New Hampshire elected official, you know, being bribed or receiving excessive gifts. We've always had, you know, I think, a really good system here and a very ethical system.
New Hampshire does have financial reporting requirements.
You got to report the money that you're bringing in for these services that you're providing. You've got to provide documentation for the money that goes out. There's separate documentation if that money happens to be going to campaign contributions.
In the Granite State, every lobbyist has to pay $50 annually to register as a lobbyist. They also pay $50 for every client they represent, and all the money in and out needs to be reported.
Yeah, so it's every dollar that is paid to the lobbyist is disclosable. And then your operating expenses are also disclosable.
The forms are supposed to be filled out in great detail, itemized. But many New Hampshire lobbyists just disregard that rule.
That is a part that is impossible to break down. If you have 35 clients and you're trying to figure out, so how much of my phone bill or my rent do I apportion to a particular client, it's impossible to do.
Thank you, Mr. President. I rise mostly wondering what it is that we're trying to repair with this. I think that this is overcomplicating of a system that has worked very well. There have been very few even complaints that something may have gone wrong. Gosh.
And then the name badges. Got to wear the name badges.
Yes, the tacky orange badges are a special Granite State regulation.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would just rise to support my colleague. The orange badge on a lobbyist lapel there or pocket is probably a good idea, so it will stop some of the confusion.
There's also caps on gifts that elected officials can accept.
The most you can give as a gift to an elected official is $50 cumulative for the year. So, you know, that pretty much ensures that people aren't playing golf or doing or going on a trip somewhere, because $50 kind of holds you down to maybe you had a lunch meeting or you met for a drink sometime and you had to disclose that, you know, you had a glass of wine. But it's capped at a pretty low amount.
New Hampshire regulations are vague, full of ambiguities. How convenient.
There are some, you know, I think pretty big loopholes or workarounds that exist. New Hampshire actually got, I believe, a D on a report card that came out in 2015 from the Center for Public Integrity, and that was looking at all kinds of things, including the level of disclosure and the level of rules that exist around lobbying. One other thing that I think is important to note is that, you know, when you look at New Hampshire relative to other states, there are a lot of things that other states do that New Hampshire doesn't do here. Some states just ban contributions between lobbyists and lawmakers. In some other states, lobbyists can only contribute to candidates that are their elected officials. So, for example, only if they live in the district where that lawmaker is a representative.
You don't necessarily have to find sneaky ways to give candidates money. You can just donate to their re-election campaign.
Ah, there it is, the big loophole.
While New Hampshire does have rules around gifts that lobbyists can give to lawmakers and the monetary amount that applies to that, no similar limit exists when it comes to campaign finance donations. So what you see is a lot of lobbyists who will give well in excess of $50 to a legislator toward his or her reelection campaign.
In New Hampshire, lobbyists can and do bankroll campaigns.
I think that the tricky thing here is candidates, whether if they're getting these donations, they vehemently argue that it does not influence their vote.
That's pay-to-play guide Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count.
There is not an expectation here that you have to make contributions in order to have access. So the sort of, as they call it, pay-for-play is really almost unheard of in New Hampshire. People don't expect that's part of the game here, thank goodness.
But some candidates rake in thousands upon thousands of dollars.
Accepted a total of $45,000, donated $25,000, limitless before a candidate declares her campaign.
It's really like kind of ingrained in the political culture here to have fundraising receptions that are heavily attended by lobbyists. So, you know, I think that it's really not uncommon for senators to host reelection campaigns, even starting, you know, as early as a month into the session, raising money for their next reelection.
New Hampshire doesn't rely on their Legislative Ethics Committee to investigate conflicts of interest. It relies on citizens to audit their own lawmakers' finances through the financial disclosure forms.
The posture of the state historically has been, look, we will make these available online. We will make these available if a individual citizen wants to come into our office at the Secretary of State's office and dig through the files or look through the actual paperwork.
New Hampshire received a failing grade for public access to information, ranked 49th in the nation.
It's frankly kind of complicated for someone to find the forms on the website. They're kind of scattered throughout all kinds of disparate pages.
It's hard to know for sure how much money is going in and how much influence that does or doesn't buy. Casey spoke with a senator whose late wife was a prominent lobbyist at the State House.
According to him, even she had a hard time winning over his votes. You know, that kind of notion that lawmakers are completely independent, they can't be swayed by lobbyists, was indicative in many of the conversations that I had with lawmakers from both parties.
That senator got about 80% of his campaign money from lobbyists.
So, you know, you can look at them, okay, they took some donations from lobbyists or these particular business interests that they're also going to be considering in legislation. And you can read into that, you know, but the legislators are going to say, you know, this is a matter of free speech. If these people support my campaign, then they're going to help me get elected. And then that doesn't necessarily influence how I'm going to vote.
Yeah, it can be like a chicken and an egg thing. Like, I'm getting the money because I already support what this lobbyist happens to be advocating for. You know, I mean, who's to say?
I'm not to say. But I do know that if I walk into the State House today, I'll see a bunch of people wearing fancy suits and orange name badges.
The question is on the adoption of ought to pass as amended on House Bill 719-FN. Are you ready for the question? All in favor say aye. All opposed, no. The ayes have it. The motion is adopted.
That's it for the show this week. This week's show was produced by Ben Henry, Sarah Gibson, Jackie Helbert, Daniela Ali, Hannah McCarthy, and me, Erica Chanik. Funding for Civics 101 comes in part from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.